أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين، لا سيما بقية الله في العالمين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. اللهم كل وليك الحجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى آبائه في هذه الساعة وفي كل ساعة، وليا وحافظا وقائدا وناصرا ودليلا وعينا، حتى تسكنه أرضك طوعا وتمتعه فيها طويلا. For the hastening and the return of our imam, please recite the salawat. Let me make this a point from the beginning. Your attendance can either make this session more beneficial and more fruitful, or it could make it very tiring for me. You are going to be causing me to be more interested in discussing what I'm about to present, or make me tired and bored of what I'm about to present. Okay. So if I see people are falling asleep, they're not participating, I'm going to cut it short as well. I don't have any personal interest in doing this. This is only for the benefit of the people. If it's not interesting to you, please make an announcement right now, either by leaving or by, I don't know. The first sign that I got from the crowd when I said, mentioned the name of the Holy Prophet, that very low volume salawat kind of turns me off. So please, this class, inshallah, is not going to be a monologue that I just present material. I want your participation, okay? I'll try to figure out some questions so I can cause you to think and, you know, respond to me. But I'm not sure if I can do that very well with this particular topic. If it was aqa'id, I would present the material in that way. You would actually have to do most of the talking. But in this type of a session, the topic that we have, I'm not sure if I have too much of that. But please, wherever you feel like something is not clear, didn't make sense, you have a question regarding it, put the question forward. If I think that the explanation requires time, I will say that inshallah we'll postpone that for the Q&A part of the session. So inshallah, please, if you guys don't like this, as I said, I'm going to cut it short. I have no, I haven't made another, as they say, for me to go on until 4 p.m. Okay, I can cut it short at 2 or 3, depending on how you guys are feeling, inshallah. I was wondering how ghulub started in history. Another thing about it is, we're not doing fiqh here, we're not doing ahkam here, okay? So I'm not going to be presenting the practical laws in regards to taqleed or marja'iyah. That's not what I'm trying to do here. What we're trying to do is have a better understanding of the history and the concept of taqleed and also marja'iyah, to then follow through to the next topic, as the brother mentioned, inshallah, tomorrow, on the concept of wilayatul faqih. Also, I need to state that, well, this topic in for the audience that I'm about to present it to, it's kind of a difficult thing to do, because usually the way this topic or these topics are discussed in the Hawza are more of a fiqhi type of discussion, trying to go over all the proofs, all the discussions. They're very academic. I'm not sure how much all of that material would be useful to the audience. So I'm not going to be able to present all of that. But nevertheless, there are certain discussions from fiqh that I will have to discuss and mention, and I hope you will bear with me, and I hope they're not too dry for you. I remember the first few years, I think, that I'd started Fiqh al-Usul in Qom, some of the Western students were telling me that, you know, how could you even sit in those classes? They're too boring, okay? So you may find those topics, I hope, I'll try to make them as interesting as possible, but please, we need to pay close attention, inshallah. I'm not sure, I don't think I would have to explain the importance of the topic too much. Okay, the topic of what we're discussing today, taqleed and marja'iyyah, are important topics. Historically, they've been important. They've had a lot of discussions regarding them. They have had a lot of pros and cons in regards to the concept of taqleed. Of course, mostly pro, but there are some cons. In regards to the concept, there's a lot of discussions, but recently, in this day and age, in our time, there's a lot of discussions in amongst the masses about this, okay? Who to follow, how to follow, is it even necessary to follow? Why are we supposed to follow, let's say, people in Qom or in Najaf, where they don't understand where we're living in, the conditions and the circumstances we're living in, and so on and so forth. So I think it's a very important discussion, it's a very important topic, it's a very important concept that we try to, inshallah, go over some of what is related to it to give us a better understanding in relation to it. Okay. Now, the first thing I'm going to do, which is pretty simple, obviously, or at first glance is pretty simple, is give a simple definition of taqleed and ijtihad. Now, marja'iyya, that's in the title of the course, marja'iyya and taqleed, there's many different conditions and qualities that are necessary for the marja' to be considered a marja', but one of the most important ones is actually the concept of ijtihad. What I'm going to talk about more is this. We want to understand this concept because I feel the questions that are related to this concept amongst us and the general public are related to the ijtihad aspect of it. There are little details about the a'lamiyya and so on and so forth that I'll try not to get to that. If people have questions related to it, we can discuss that in the Q&A part of the session, inshallah. I'm going to give a brief definition of each of them, taqleed and ijtihad. Ijtihad, well, it's got a background to it. We have to understand. The word, the title ijtihad, okay, this term that is used, has got some baggage with it. I don't know if you've ever tried to look that word up or if you've been on any discussions online, any fruitless discussions online, because a lot of them are really like that. But anyway, some of them are beneficial. I don't want to put down all of them, but sometimes when I read it, I just feel like, you know, I really don't know what the point of these discussions are. Anyhow, about the word ijtihad being used in the ahadith, okay, and we have some condemnation regarding that the term ijtihad. It's had different meanings before. We've had, there's a book related to this topic, ijtihad in nas, where ijtihad goes against nas, nas meaning scripture, ahadith and verses of the Holy Quran. And ijtihad being something that is opposite to that, doing ijtihad where there is nas, and trying to condemn that. Usually some of the Shia ulama have written books along those lines to try to raise awareness about some of the mistakes that have been done by and committed by the scholars of other schools of thought. But what we mean by ijtihad, which is a meaning and definition for this word that developed in the 7th century approximately, where Muhaqqiq Hilli kind of explains this. Of course, it probably developed a little earlier, but what we see it, or when we see it very clearly, is during the time of Muhaqqiq Hilli in the 7th century. It is basically, very basically, the process, the ability to derive practical laws from their sources. Derive what our practical responsibility is, how we are supposed to pray, how we are supposed to perform our sawm, fasting, how we are supposed to perform hajj, what are our obligations, what are the muharramat, what we've been forbidden from. The process of deriving that from the sources that we have is called ijtihad. Okay. Now, I'm giving you my definition. I'm trying to make it simple. Otherwise, if you look at the definitions that have been given in fiqh books, there's a huge discussion on that. There's pages that they try to give the different definitions that are presented and then say what the problems with them are and then coming up with their own definition. I want to skip all of that. This is a simple definition that I try to give. And taqleed is basically when it comes to our practical laws, when it comes to practicing our religion, referring to a person who does have the quality of ijtihad and learning the practical laws through them. That's as simple as I can put it. Okay. Now we're going to try to develop that a little better through the discussions that we have. Recite a salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
If there is
a Muhammad.
There's a lot of questions that are raised, as I said, in regards to ijtihad. I don't know how much of that you've heard. Okay. About, for example, what is even the necessity of having mujtahids in the first place? Okay, and having to refer to them. Why can't we pick up hadith books or the verses and try to understand the practical implications that it has for us? I can read the hadith. The hadith is saying such and such, and I understand it, and I apply that. I don't need to refer to a mujtahid. Some have gone even further and tried to say that the practice of taqleed is not only something that is not necessary, it is actually something that is not allowed. Okay, it is haram to refer to a mujtahid or someone else, as they say, someone that is not ma'soom. In order to tackle some of these issues, we need to first understand what the process of ijtihad entails. What is this process? Okay. What are the requirements of ijtihad? One of the things that happens a lot for people who go to the hawza, you're there for 6 months or a year, you pay a visit back to your community, to your relatives, and people ask you to give lectures. Okay. They think you've been there for a year, you should know a whole lot. Okay. They think you've been there for 2 years, oh my God, you know, this guy is Allama or something. Okay. 3 years, then it becomes... What is that? Marja, there you go. No, seriously, there are some expectations like that, okay? And the reason behind that, and the reason why I'm about to explain what I want to explain, is because we have an understanding of academia. We've studied, a lot of us have studied in universities, we've taken courses, we've had classes. There's a standard, okay, for what you study, how long you study to accomplish, you know, a certain level of scholarship out here. Okay, 4 years you get a bachelor's degree, 6 years you get a master's degree, and then I don't know how many years after that you can get a PhD depending on the field that you're in. Okay, so 4 years is considered a whole lot. But for ijtihad, okay, we have got to go over a list of sciences or disciplines before we can do this. Okay, first one is Arabic. I think it's pretty obvious. Okay, but the reason why I'm mentioning this is it kind of baffles me. I don't know whether to laugh at it or cry at this, but people get onto maraja, get onto scholars in relation to Islamic topics, okay, they can't even read a word of Arabic. They picked up a translation of the book or a translation of the Holy Quran, and they're reading it and they're getting on to people for their understanding. Why is this marja saying this? Why is this scholar saying this? I read the hadith of Imam Asad. You can't even understand the Arabic. Words make a huge difference. Okay. We need to realize translations aren't the original book, aren't the original work. Just compare the different translations that you have, for example, of the Holy Quran. How many different translations do you have? Okay. Plenty of them. And if more people would do translation, you'll find more and more differences. Okay. It's not just in the wording, the format of the sentence structure. The concept that is presented is very different. Very different. Okay. The more you read it, the more you realize that. Okay. A hadith that have been translated, the quality of much of those translations is very, very low. Okay, it really doesn't give you that picture. And even if it's a high quality, you are not reading the word of the Imam. That's a fact. You are reading the understanding of this person, okay, who has translated it. He has chosen that this word means such and such, and the equivalent of that word is this in English. Okay. You're not reading the words of the Imam. A lot of the debates, discussions amongst the ulama in understanding the text is regarding these things. What does this word mean? It has 50 meanings. It has 5 meanings. So the 50 is not an exaggeration. There are words that have 50 meanings in the Arabic language. Okay. Now there's a discussion whether it means one or the other. The context makes a huge difference, but nevertheless, the topic, the discussion is about the meaning and the understanding of the words, the Arabic words of it. It's how can we make judgments about religion, about what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, and the verses of the Holy Quran emphasize and insist that Allahu adhina lakum am ala Allahi taftaroon. Do you have clear evidence that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said something, or you are saying, attributing things to Allah which you don't have any foundation for? It's very, very dangerous to speak on behalf of the religion, say God has said this, the Imam has said this. It's not easy. I don't know if you've checked out you should have seen, those especially who understand Arabic, a lot of the times when a marja, a pious marja, would answer a question in regards to your practical law, you would ask him a question, they would tell you, this is al-aqwa, the stronger view, in my humble opinion, is such and such, and it says, Wallahu al-alim, God knows best, or God actually knows. We don't really know 100%. They take all these precautions. But we, unfortunately, don't do that. So the first thing that needs to be studied is Arabic. For some reason, people who haven't been in the Hawza kind of think that Arabs are an exception to that, because they already know Arabic. All right. And outside of the Hawza, we find people that have some level of understanding of the Arabic language, and they think that it's completely valid and okay to pick up those books of hadith and read it and say, oh, this is what it means, and then get on to others because of that. That is not the case. Arab students as well in the Hawza have got to go through formal studies and learn Arabic literature so they don't understand or misunderstand the words of the Ahlul Bayt and the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the first thing that needs to be studied is Arabic. The grammar of it, the literature needs to be studied amongst the Arabs. It probably takes about a year, year and a half, 2 years. For the non-Arabs, it takes about 3 years to learn that. One of the other sciences that needs to be studied is logic. Okay. Now, logic isn't something that you see very clearly in the reasoning and the discussions of the fuqaha in deriving practical laws. They don't say it's based on this logical principle. But it's kind of a practice to sharpen the faculty of the intellect. So when we're looking at the hadith, we're able to distinguish between and see the differences there, okay? And be able to split hair and not make mistakes, okay? So logic, that is another subject that we have. The study of hadith is not something that, as I said, I repeated this a couple of times or a few times, you just pick up a hadith book and read it. Even if you formally studied Arabic, even if you spent the 3 years or 2 years or whatever number of years studying Arabic grammar and you're very well versed in Arabic, hadith doesn't only include or doesn't only require Arabic, even the best knowledge of Arabic, to understand. Okay. The reason, there's plenty of reasons, I can't list all of them. The process of compilation of hadith, when did that happen? How did it happen? Okay. How valid, how reliable are the books of hadith that we have? Which ones are more reliable, which ones are less reliable? Which author is more careful, which one is less? What era were these books written in? What were the actual and original sources? Who started writing these ahadith? Okay. Do we have any fabrications that were put into our hadith books? These are serious questions that require thorough discussion. Then another concept, another idea that's very important is the context of hadith. The words change meanings. Okay. As I said, the word ijtihad, if you just take the word ijtihad in our understanding, the term ijtihad in today, and you want to go and understand the hadith that use the word ijtihad, you're going to completely misunderstand it, because they say ijtihad is haram. Okay. If you do ijtihad, you're committing the greatest sin in the world. But what that means is completely different. You got to look at the context. What was the word ijtihad meaning during that time? You got to know the background behind that. Okay. Understanding the circumstances and the environment that the Ahlul Bayt spoke. Okay. Sometimes they were in the state of taqiyah, sometimes they weren't. Sometimes they were talking where there were people from the other schools of thought, Sunnis around. Sometimes they were speaking all amongst the Shia. Sometimes the Shia that they spoke to were not really, true Shias in the real sense of the word, although they considered themselves Shia. They were maybe from the Mufawwidah, they were Muqassara, there were other schools of thought that were around them. Okay. Understanding that context is very important. We can't just pick out a hadith and say, okay, this is what it means. The study of Rijal is also, it's related to hadith, but in the discussion of hadith, what I meant by that, what I tried to emphasize on, was the collections of hadith that we have. For example, let me give another example in regards to hadith. It's a big mistake to pick out a hadith from Wasa'il al-Shia and interpret it. Why? Because Wasa'il al-Shia is a later compilation. Okay. And what Sahib al-Wasa'il, Shaykh Hurr al-Amili, rahmatullah alayhi, did was he basically took parts of the hadith. There was one hadith that is quoted in, let's say, Al-Kafi. It's about a page long or two pages. One of those sentences, two of those sentences, according to the understanding of Hurr al-Amili, is related to the subject of Salat, and it tells you how many rak'ah to do, or if you're doing Qasr, if you're Kathir al-Safar, what your ruling is. He takes those two sentences and brings it over there in that section, in that chapter, and says, this is what Qulayni narrates. Okay. Well, the context is very important. Maybe if I read from the beginning to the end of that hadith, I have a completely different understanding of it than if I just pick out those two sentences. And it does make a huge difference there. That's why another compilation of hadith was gathered later on, more recently, the past 30, 40 years, by Ayatollah Burujerdi, Jam'u Ahadith al-Shia, where he brings the entire hadith. For every chapter, he repeats that. He doesn't only bring those two sentences. Okay. Now, amongst the original hadith books, even that happens. Qulayni, for example, is one that when he brings the ahadith, sometimes he does the same thing. It's called taqti'ah. He cuts up the hadith. He doesn't give you what the Imam has said entirely in that one session. He just gives you that little passage of it. Okay, that makes a huge difference in the understanding of it. And when you compare that to Shaykh At-Tusi's, you see, okay, his narration has got a more complete report of what actually happened. When you know these things, it makes a huge difference in the understanding. Rijal, though, talks about the narrators. The narrators are very important to understand. In fiqh, it's important when you see that this person is fatahi, when you see this person is waqifi, when you see this person is from another school of thought, okay, and he's reporting something, it makes a big difference. Let me give you an example. Now, the example that I'm about to give is not related to the differences in the school of thought of these people. It's the personality of the individual. Okay, we have a person at the time of Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi. His name is Sadir al-Sayrafi. He's a companion of the Imam. His son is a companion of the Imam. His son actually has more ahadith, but Sadir also has hadith. Okay. One of the ahadith that Sadir narrates, okay, is something related to tomorrow's discussion, okay, which we'll have to address, in relation to having uprisings before the coming of Imam al-Hujjah ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. Okay. Are we allowed to do that or are we not allowed to do that? One of the ahadith that is used against that is a hadith that's reported by Sadir al-Sayrafi. Okay. Sadir al-Sayrafi narrates that the Imam told him during that time, during the time of Imam al-Sadiq, there was a lot of uprising. You know, you should know, we should know, we should try to learn the history of our Imams during the time of Imam al-Sadiq. That's when Bani Umayyah were very weak. Bani al-Abbas and others were doing uprisings. Eventually, it was Bani al-Abbas that were able to take control, and they started that dynasty up. Okay, so before Bani al-Abbas gained strength, there were a lot of uprisings. The uprisings, many of them were from the Alawis as well. Okay, Zayd is one of the Alawis that has an uprising. Zayd, the son of Imam al-Sajjad. We have others, Hassan al-Muthanna, the son of Hassan al-Muthanna, Abdullah, he has uprisings. We have, later on, the son of Imam al-Sadiq also having uprisings. I want to give this impression that there are uprisings by the Alawids, okay? By the children of Imam al-Mujtaba, the children of Imam al-Husayn. In that context, the Shia would come to the Imams and ask them, what should we do? Sometimes some of them were very hot-headed, you know, these guys are tyrants, the Umayyads are this, that, the other, they've oppressed you, they've killed your father, so on and so forth. We should have an uprising, why aren't you doing? Let's do something. There's different wordings. Sadir al-Sayrafi, he also comes to the Imam. The Imam tells him, don't join any of these movements. Okay. Before the coming of our Imam, you need to be the rug of your house. It's an expression used to say you need to remain in your house. You shouldn't come out and have any form of uprising with against any tyranny. Well, we've got to look at the background. Who is this Sadir? Okay. Is that the only thing that the Imam has said? Sadir is a very, very weak figure. Okay. Very weak in his faith. He's able to turn and go the opposite direction because of the pressure of the people that are around him. Okay. The Imam tells him, look, you need to remain silent. You shouldn't be part of this. The same way that, I don't know if you heard this, in one of the sessions we went over this, during the, when Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah alayhi became the Khalifa of the time, and there was an uprising against him by, Umm al-Mu'mineen Aisha and Talha and Zubayr. When the Imam tried to recruit people from Kufa, Abu Musa al-Ash'ari stood up and quoted something from the Holy Prophet. He quoted the Holy Prophet saying that when fitna, there will be a fitna after me. During that fitna, do not join any group. Remain silent. Don't take arms. Okay. Don't say anything. Actually, the wording was, don't say anything in this fitna. Okay. He says that. And he tells people you shouldn't join any of the two parties. Then one of the other companions, I believe it was Ammar ibn Yasir, he turns back to him and says, yes, that is what the Prophet said, but that was addressed to you, and it's because of you. You are not very wise, you don't know how to pick sides, you don't know how to deal with such circumstances. The Holy Prophet told you to, in my words, just shut up, okay? Don't say anything. And you just went against what he told you. He told you not to say anything, you stood up and said something. Okay. So the person who is reporting this, yes, it may be the saying of the Imam, but it may be something that is addressed to that particular individual that doesn't apply to us. That could be understood sometimes through knowing who that person is. Through knowing whether the person is reliable or not. A lot of the ahadith that are thrown around and people try to make, draw this picture about the coming of our Imam, okay? What's going to happen? It's very interesting topic for everybody to, you know, try to figure out, yeah, this is going to happen, then that's going to happen, then, you know, so-and-so is, you know, the Yemeni, or this person is the Khurasani, and all of that. A lot of those ahadith, okay, have got someone by the name of Hassan ibn Ali ibn Abi Hamza al-Bata'ini. This guy's a liar. He's a known liar, okay? When he's someone that is known, crystal clear in our history, that not only did he lie a lot, but also he had an incorrect view, a deviant view in regards to the Imam of our time, in regards to the Qa'im, in regards to the Mahdi. He believed that Imam al-Kadhim is the Mahdi. Okay. So he has a deviant view, and he was actually one of the ones that pushed that ideology forward. He's known to fabricate hadith. And we want to take his hadith and explain what's going to happen during the end of time? We can't do that. Rijal is an important topic in an important discussion, important discipline in ijtihad. The next discipline, which is very important, is tafsir. Scholar has got to be able to go through the verses of the Holy Quran and properly understand them. Okay. Understanding the Holy Quran is not an easy job, it's not an easy task. There's a lot of different views of how we're even supposed to understand the Holy Quran. This is not to say people are not supposed to read the translation of and try to contemplate and reflect on it. No, we've got to use the resources that are available to us to try to understand the religion as much as we can. Okay. However, that's going to be a limited understanding. There's a lot of issues that need to be dealt with in order to understand it correctly. Okay. Couple of examples. How important is the context of the verses? Okay. Context not meaning the when they were revealed, because that is something that's related to hadith. All right. Hadith tells us when this verse was revealed. And then we have a combination, it becomes even more complicated. Because hadith and the verse, we have got to resolve some of the issues that we have about understanding of the verses of the Holy Quran. And also the hadith, the reliability of it. How reliable is that hadith? Many of the hadith that we have talk about the context in the sense of, you know, the time and the location and the event that this verse was revealed. Many of them don't have very strong reporters reporting them. They don't have strong chains of narrators. Okay. So not that. What I mean by the context is this. There's this this sentence in this verse comes in between a bunch of other sentences, right? These sentences come one after the other. The verses, sometimes a verse may not even have a full sentence. It continues to the next verse. Sometimes it consists of many sentences. Okay. Now the flow of these verses and these sentences, okay, how important is that in understanding it? Can we take part of that verse and understand it and take a practical law from it? Or we need to put it with the rest of the sentence and understand it and makes a difference, okay, and take that and take a practical law from it. If the story makes a difference in the understanding of it, is that important? I'll give you an example because that's a little abstract what I'm giving you. One example that is discussed, I'm sure you've all heard, okay, which kind of pushes one of these two views in regards to tafsir, is the verse of Tathir. Okay. The verse of Tathir is in between verses that are talking about the wives of the Holy Prophet. Okay. If context, in the sense that we explained, is very important, okay, if this verse falls into the context of verses that are talking about the wives of the Holy Prophet, okay, if the masculine tense is used, which it is, right, it's going to include some males in it, but since it's in the context of talking about the wives of the Holy Prophet, it should include them as well, unless we have some explanation for it. Okay, that's a dilemma that we would be facing. How do we resolve that issue? Okay, if we agree that the context is going to change the meaning. If we don't, what about that? We have another verse that I'm sure at least some of us here have heard. فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّهْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ Okay, what is this what does this verse refer to? Go to أَهْلُ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ If you don't know. Who are أَهْلُ الذِّكْرِ? Who are أَهْلُ الذِّكْرِ? We have hadith, for example, that says أَهْلُ الذِّكْرِ are the أَهْلُ الْبَيْتِ. Okay. Can we take that hadith to interpret that verse? That's one thing. But the other thing is, some people have used this hadith in regards to the concept of taqlid that we are discussing. They say, okay, the verse says, فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ If you don't know, ask those who know. That's their definition. That's their interpretation. I don't want to dispute that and say whether or not that is correct. But فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ They've used it in fiqh. All right. Go and do taqlid. Ask those who know if you don't know. If you haven't studied, if you can't derive the practical laws yourself, ask those who know. As simple as that. Others turn back and say, well, the context of this verse is talking about aqa'id. It's addressed to the people that are not even Muslim. How could it be talking about taqlid? Okay. It's addressing people who are not listening to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's giving them a logical solution. If you have doubts regarding a human being the messenger of God that brings down revelation and explains the message to you, if you have questions regarding that, go to Ahlul Dhikr. And Dhikr in that sense wouldn't be just anyone that knows. It's referring to the people of the book. It's actually referring us to non-Muslims. How could that be related to Taqleed? Okay. Now if you take that, just that sentence, it could be into, it's a general concept. فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Whether it's regarding aqal, whether it's regarding fiqh, whether it's regarding whatever it may be. Okay. But if we're supposed to take that context into consideration, then this is talking about aqal. It has nothing to do with fiqh. So we cannot use that. Okay. There's a lot of such discussions. There's a lot of different views on that. How do we decide something is muhkam? How do we decide something is mutashabih? What is the relationship of hadith with the verses of the Holy Quran? These are very extensive discussions. Another thing, compilation of the Holy Quran. How did that happen? When did that happen? How relevant is that in our understanding of the Holy Quran? These are very important discussions. Then, we have, well, in the sequence that I talked about, I came to, you know, I tried to mention them in the order of importance. Okay. One of the other subjects that we have that we study for in the Hawza from basically after doing Arabic grammar, it takes about standard in traditional Hawza system is for it to take about 7 years. Okay. We go through usul, and 7 years is before even getting to kharij. Okay, bahthul kharij is its own thing that we'll discuss that a bit too. There's 7 years of studying books of usul, and then you get to bahthul kharij, you gotta do a few years of that before you can become a mujtahid. What is the study of usul? Usul al-fiqh are the principles of jurisprudence. Some of the questions that are raised in regards to understanding the Holy Quran are discussed here. For example, the relationship between hadith and the Quran. Can we have a hadith that can interpret the verse of the Holy Quran, that can exclude some of what is included in the verse? Okay, the verse just says, generally speaking, for example, I'll give you a simple example that I think there is a difference of opinion amongst the fuqaha. There is, I know for a fact there is. And amongst the different schools of thought, there's a difference of opinion on this. Okay, can we eat whatever comes from the sea or not? Can you eat lobsters? Can you eat clam? Can you eat, I don't know, whatever, octopus? If you like to eat that, can you eat it or not? Okay, there's two different views. I'm sure you've heard. Some people say whatever comes from the ocean, from the sea, from the water, you can eat it, it's halal. Okay, where do you get that from? The verse of the Holy Quran. It says, what's in the, we've provided you food from the sea, you can eat from the sea. They take that, okay, that's a general thing. It says you can eat from the sea. Okay, we have hadith that says you can only eat fish with scales and shrimp. All right. Can you use that hadith and say, okay, that hadith limits the verse. The verse said you can eat whatever from the ocean, but this hadith interprets whatever means whatever has scales and shrimp. It doesn't mean whatever other than these. Okay. Amongst these types of fish that have scales on them, you can eat whatever, not everything else. Okay, that is one understanding. Another understanding is, no, that's not the case. The verse is clearly saying that everything you can eat. Okay, I'm not saying if that is what the verse is saying. Okay, be careful with what I'm giving. These are examples. There's a lot of debate on this. There's a lot of discussion on this. There are some of the Shia fuqaha that present the idea in this way. The verse says clearly that all of the animals, anything that comes from the sea is edible. That's the verse of the Holy Quran. If we have a hadith that goes against that, it's logical. And we have hadith, whatever goes against the Quran, فَضْرِبُهُ عَلَى الْجِدَارِ, throw it away, it's not said by us. Okay, so that's what we treat this hadith like. Okay, now, can we have that? Can we not have that? Does it have to contradict it completely? Or if something comes and excludes part of what the verse is including, like the example that I mentioned, is that also a contradiction that we cannot use? How strong does it have to be? If you only have one hadith, even if it has reliable sources, can we take that one hadith and say, although the verse includes all the animals, anything that comes from the sea, but this one hadith or two hadiths, that we can barely consider them reliable, but they are reliable, they can come and cause us to have a different view regarding the verse. Can we do that? Can we not? Okay. These are serious discussions. Hadith. What type of hadith can we accept? What type of hadith do we reject? Okay. What is considered an authentic hadith? Is it such that we need to establish that this person is reliable? Do we need to go through the resources to the Rijal books and find out if this person is reliable? Or can we just say that, okay, if it's in Kutub al-Arba'a, it is sufficient. It doesn't matter who narrates it. Okay. Is the ideology of the person important or not? We have people that had deviant ideologies. We have fatahis. Okay. Hasan ibn Ali ibn Fadhal, for example. He's fatahi. Okay. They believe in Abdullah al-Aftah after Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi. They believe in another imam. Okay. According to them, it's not clear whether they believed in 13 imams or they believed in, only up to Abdullah al-Aftah. There's different views about what their ideology was. We don't have any fatahis around us today to ask them, what do you believe? But anyway, they definitely believed in this other imam called Abdullah al-Aftah. Well, he has plenty of ahadith. He's considered someone that is thiqah, okay, but he has these deviant views. Okay, what do we do with that? Do we accept his hadith? Do we not accept him? If a person is Sunni, he narrates a hadith for us, okay, but he's considered reliable, especially if that view that he narrates, he says Imam al-Sadiq said such and such. When we look at the hadith, it actually is the same view that the Sunnis have. Can we take that? Can we not? Do we consider that? So hadith, what type of hadith? Another important discussion, what do we do where we don't find clear evidence for the ruling? Okay, what's the principle there? Okay, what's the practical principle there? If we can't figure out, we don't have clear hadith this way or the other way. Or a better example, I was going to talk about called Usul al-Amaliyya. Okay, I was going to talk about that, but let me give a better example. What do you do when you have a hadith that are contradicting? Okay, it's very clear that we have plenty of ahadith in our books. I don't want to give the impression that there's like a huge number, but there are enough and they are significant. Inshallah, the examples that I will, I have some examples for you that inshallah we'll go over. What are we supposed to do with it? How are we supposed to treat them? Okay. Which one are we supposed to take? That's very important. If we can't come up with that, then we're not going to be able to do ijtihad appropriately. We're not going to be able to get the correct understanding of our religion. And the last one that we do is fiqh itself. Okay, basically first going over ahkam, learning what the views of the current maraja are, for example, or one of the previous maraja. For example, Urwa is a book that is very commonly done. Then after that we start to do get into basic reasoning. The book that is usually done is Lum'at al-Dimashqiyya by Shahid al-Thani, which is a commentary on Shahid al-Awwal's book. The commentary is called Ar-Rawdatul Bahiyya fi Sharh al-Lum'at al-Dimashqiyya. Anyhow, it's a book with its commentary. It takes about 3 years to study that. Okay, and that's just basic, very, very basic reasoning. Okay, very basic reasoning. Then after that, we get into Makasib of Shaykh al-Ansari. That takes about 4 years to do. After all of that, learning how these other ulama have done it, we go to Bahth al-Kharij, and the marja, the mujtahid, tries to walk us through this process and give the different views, the different reasonings, okay, different ahadith, different understandings of these ahadith, and come up with, they explain the different views there and refute the ones that they disagree with and present what they consider reliable and what is considered acceptable to them. And through that, gradually a person is able to develop that for themselves. These are the sciences, the disciplines that need to be studied before one can consider themselves someone that can refer to the ahadith, refer to the verses of the Holy Quran, refer to the sources. I need to generalize because we'll mention some examples that may not even technically be considered hadith. Going to the resources that we have and deriving the practical laws. It takes all of this. And I think I kind of explained why this is all necessary. Otherwise, if we just refer to a translation, if we just refer to the Holy Quran, even if we know the Arabic language, we're not going to be able to come up with an appropriate understanding. Let me give you an example of this. Okay, I want to give a couple of examples of this whole process of ijtihad. I'll start with maybe a simple one. Okay. Oh, it's not simple, but I'm trying to present it in a simple way. Okay. We refer to wasa'il al-shi'a, for example, in this case that's what I'm doing. We find There's a chapter, first of all, finding the hadith itself is something that takes some time. Because Hur al-Amali rahmatullah alayhi has categorized hadith based on his understanding. He said, I think this hadith is related to this topic, and he's put it under the title of, you know, whatever he considers that to be. Okay. Now we may look at that and say, actually, you know what? It doesn't mean what he has understood from it. Okay. It means something completely different. Or it has something in there that on top of what Shaykh Hur al-Amali has mentioned, it also has a second indication there that helps us in somewhere else, and Hur al-Amali has not mentioned it in the other chapter. Okay. So you can't just go to a chapter and say, okay, Babu wujub salat al-dhuhr inda al-zawal, for example. Salat al-dhuhr becomes wajib when the sun starts going towards the western horizon. You can't just go there, look at only the hadith there and say, okay, I've found all the hadith. No, there may be plenty of other hadith that we didn't come to know. But I'm trying to simplify it. We go to this chapter, we find there's a list of hadith, there's over 20 hadith. That itself kind of, you know, tells us that it's not a very controversial issue. They're pretty much all indicating the same thing. Of course, there is actually, when you have that many hadith, sometimes it's a controversial issue. But they're all indicating the same thing. Okay. I'll give you one of the ahadith that we have here. Okay, this is hadith number 23 of this bab. It's the fourth bab of Abwab al-Mawaqid in Wasail al-Shia. Okay. First of all, the hadith starts like this. Wa'an Muhammad ibn Yahya. If it's the first time you're referring to Wasail al-Shia, you wouldn't even know where this is coming from. You don't know what the source is, you don't know who this is reported from. Wa'an Muhammad ibn Yahya, Shaykh Hur al-Amali usually does that. He brings one of the authors like Kulayni, Muhammad ibn Ya'qub al-Kulayni, an filan. Then the hadith that follow says wa'an filan. In other words, it's Kulayni narrating these, so he doesn't mention Kulayni again. So this one, wa'an Muhammad ibn Yahya. Muhammad ibn Yahya is one of the teachers of Kulayni, one of the greatest ulama that we've had. Very reliable, no question about him. Wa'an Muhammad ibn Yahya. An Ahmad ibn Muhammad. Ahmad ibn Muhammad, in this, like this is one of the shuyukh that was claiming to be a mujtahid. Recently we saw this and it was kind of surprising. He'd written a book about a very important discussion that we have in Hajj. Okay, can we do tawaf on the second floor or not? Okay, if we can, it makes life a lot easier for a lot of people. Okay, if we can't, then it's very difficult. Those who've been to Hajj know what I'm talking about. Alhamdulillah, we had the opportunity to go. But anyway, he had a book on that. One of the things that he talks about, one of the ahadith that he brings, he comes to this person, says either Muhammad ibn Yahya or one of the other people, Hiddatin min ashabina, for example, an Ahmad ibn Muhammad. If you go to Rijal books, there's about 30 people that have the name Ahmad ibn Muhammad. Who is this Ahmad ibn Muhammad? Okay. You can't just pick and choose. There's five of them that are reliable. Inshallah, this is one of the reliable ones. This is, maybe it's not. But when you do research, Ahmad ibn Muhammad, that Muhammad ibn Yahya narrates from, is one of two. It's either Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Isa al-Ash'ari al-Qumi, who is a reliable person, or it's Ahmad ibn Muhammad ibn Abi Abdullah al-Barqi, who is also from Qum, and he's also reliable. So it doesn't make a difference which one it is. They're both reliable, and it can't be anybody else. It's crystal clear. An ibn Faddal. Ibn Faddal, there's a list of brothers. Now again, can we figure out, do we need to figure that out? No. Ibn Faddal, first of all, is probably Ali ibn Faddal. Possibly some of the other ones. The more famous one, I think, if I remember correctly, actually, I'll correct that. There's a few brothers, they're all reliable, they're all great ulama. These are the Fatahis, I just mentioned one of their names. Hasan ibn Ali ibn Fadhal is one of the Fatahis. His children, his brothers, they're all Fatahis. Ibn Fadhal, it doesn't matter which one it is, because they're all reliable. An ibn Bukayr is reliable. Uwayd ibn Zurara, Najashi says he's reliable. All these people are considered reliable. Very crystal clear in Rijal books. There's no question about it. He says, "Kuntu ana wa nafarun min ashabina mutarafiqin." Then he mentions, I don't want to mention the whole hadith. He says, I was trying to, because the bab, the title of the bab is the chapter. The title of the chapter is that Dhuhr and Asr both become wajib at the time of Zawal. Okay, this is one of the discussions. Is there a specific time only for Dhuhr that we cannot do Asr during that time, and then afterwards the time of Asr comes in? Obviously we know there's a difference of opinion. The other schools of thought believe that no, during the time of Dhuhr you can only do Dhuhr. Okay, then the time of Asr comes in a little later on, and you pray your Asr at that time. So we're looking at the ahadith that talk about this. He says, he doesn't quote the imam. He says, we were doubtful whether the time of dhuhr has come in. And he talks about that story. But the important thing that is relevant to this topic, he says, hatta arada lana, we were talking about whatever we talk about, qitaru Abi Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam. The imam came with the people around him. فَقُلْتُ أَتَى الْقِطَالِ فَرَأَيْتُ مُحَمَّدَ بْنَ إِسْمَعِيلَ فَقُلْتُ لَهُ صَلَّيْتُمْ فَقَالَ لِي أَمَرَنَا جَدِّي فَصَلَّيْنَا الظُّهْرَ وَالْعَصْرَ جَمِيعًا. Okay. The time of dhuhr had come in, the time of asr was not in. He says, he quotes his father, Muhammad ibn Ismail, quotes his grandfather actually, Ismail is the son of the imam. The Ismailis actually believe in this son of the imam, who he passed away during the lifetime of Imam al-Sadiq. Anyway, Muhammad, the grandson of Imam al-Sadiq, says, my grandfather ordered us or told us to pray both Dhuhr and Asr, and we did so. This is a very clear indication that when the time of Dhuhr comes in, the practice of the Imam shows us that. It's pretty straightforward. It's not too difficult. Okay. Now, in the same list of Abwab, in the same section in Wasail, we have another chapter, and that is on the topic of the time of Salatul Maghrib. Okay, Salatul Maghrib. One of the common understandings that we have is that there's a difference between Shia and Sunni in regards to the time of Maghrib, right? Sunset is considered, the common knowledge is sunset is considered Maghrib for Ahlul Sunnah. And for us, we can't do our Maghrib prayer at that time. We're supposed to do it after the Habu Humrat al Mashriqiyah. It's about 15-20 minutes afterwards, depending on where you're at. Okay. That's the common understanding, right? It's even if anybody has a different view, we would oppose them and say, you know, this is they've become Sunni or something. But when we refer to this chapter, we find that actually, well, the hadith are different. The first 15 or so hadith that are narrated, the imams have said, I won't go through the rajal. I gave the example of the rajal that was simple, but here we have a list of ahadith that say, إذا غابت الحمرة من هذا الجانب يعني من المشرق فقد غابت الشمس من شرق الأرض وغربها. Okay. It's one hadith. Another hadith. The companions have narrated وقت المغرب إذا ذهبت الحمرة من المشرق. Very clear, right? The time for Maghrib is when the Humra leaves Mashriq, the eastern horizon. When that redness in the sky is basically comes above your head and you don't see it in the eastern horizon anymore, then that's the time of Maghrib, not when the sun sets. Okay. There's about 15 or 16 hadith like this. Then we have another list of hadith. Recite a salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Abdullah ibn Sanan, one of the great companions, he's very reliable, no question about him. Okay. I'll read, this one is a crystal clear chain of narrators as well. Muhammad ibn Ya'qub Kulayni, an iddatun min ashabina, an Ahmad ibn Muhammad, an al-Husayn ibn Sa'id. They're all iddatun min ashabina, there's discussion, everybody accepts their reliability. Ahmad ibn Muhammad, we already mentioned, it's either Ibn Isa or Barqi, an al-Husayn ibn Sa'id, he's also very reliable, very well known. Nadr ibn Suwaid, very well known. Thiqa, Abdullah ibn Sanan, very well known. An Abi Abdullah alayhi salatu wa salam. Qal sami'tuhu yaqul waqtul maghrib idha ghabatish shamsu fa ghaba qursuha. The time of Maghrib is when the sun is not seen in the horizon. It's a Sunni view. There's a list of hadith after this. Okay, what do we do here? How do we understand this? When you go to the, refer to the ulama as well, there's difference of opinion in trying to put these into context, especially because the number of ahadith that talk about the time of Maghrib being when the sun sets in the horizon are actually more. There's a huge discussion. Different fiqh books have tried to give different views. Out of the recent ulama, Ayatollah Bahjat rahmatullah alayhi actually believe the time of Maghrib is sunset. Okay. So what do we do in this case? Which one? Are we going to condemn the Shias? Are we going to condemn the Sunnis? Are we going to condemn which? What are we going to do here? Okay. It's not easy. You have to look at a lot of different things before we can understand this. Another example, and I'll try to make this one quick. Recite a salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa
4 minutes? Inshallah, I'll try to finish it in 4 minutes. Another example is something that we deal with a lot over here. Okay. Tahara and Nijasatu Ahlil Kitab. Are the Christians and Jews Tahir or Najis? Okay. We have clear hadith that says they are, well, I won't say clear hadith, there's a difference of opinion. Maybe I would consider them clear, but others have not considered them as clear. We have hadith that even according to many of those who believe that Ahlul Kitab, Christians and Jews, along with Mushrikeen, are Najis, whether they've touched Najasa or not, they themselves are Najis, okay? Many of those who have that view acknowledge and agree that the ahadith that talk about them being tahir are crystal clear. There's no question about them. All right. So why in the world have all a whole bunch of maraja and ulama said that they are najis? Imam Khomeini had an ihtiyat wajib that they are najis. Adla Khoui had an ihtiyat wajib that they are najis. Plenty of other ulama have had views that they are najis. Traditional ulama, the qudama, Shaykh Tusi, and many of the others consider them najis. But today, Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei, I think Sayyid Fadlullah, I'm pretty sure Sayyid Fadlullah, Ayatollah Makarim Shirazi, I'll take that back. Many of the ulama believe that they're tahir. Okay. What's the reason behind this difference of opinion? Well, there's a claim of ijma'. We have to go through the sources. There's a lot of different things. I want to mention this briefly, of course. There's an ijma'. People say, at least, there's an ijma'. Okay, whether there is or not, that's subject to discussion. Maybe someone would go over it and say we don't have ijma'. Anyway, with the assumption that there is ijma', Imam Khomeini explains this. I wanted to kind of read parts of that, but because of the shortage of time, I'll skip that. This example that we were talking about tahara or the najasa of Ahlul Kitab. Hadith, according to like Imam Khomeini himself, he agrees. He says that it's clear the ahadith say that Ahlul Kitab are tahir, right? On the other hand, we have ijma'. Question comes up, and I think in these forums, I think it's one of those hot topics that people will be attacking some of these maraja based on that. How could you go against the word of Imam al-Sadiq? Imam al-Sadiq has said this, Imam al-Sadiq has said that. How could we do that? We go against Ahlul Sunnah. We say, how dare you go against Nas because of your ijtihad? This is an example of that, and an attack. These ulama, are we going to accept, or do we believe that these ulama are, you know, trying to just give some opinion of themselves, or do we consider the view of the ulama as more important than the words of the Ahlul Bayt? If all of the ulama that consider themselves Shia, okay, if all of them have one view, and we know for a fact that the Ahlul Bayt had a different view, who are we going to side with? Ahlul Bayt, very clearly. There's no question about it, right? So in this example, people will be asking, the Ahlul Bayt have said one thing, ulama have said something else. We get on to people who went against the saying of the Holy Prophet in Ghadir, okay? And now we're doing the same thing. This is, we told you from the beginning, ijtihad is wrong, and you know, all of that. I've seen such discussions. Well, that's looking at it very simplistically, not understanding, as I said, the context, okay? None of the Shia ulama believes that the words of ulama carries any type of weight except for explaining to us what the Ahlul Bayt have said. Nothing more than that. If we can come to the conclusion through an ijma' that this is the view of the Ahlul Bayt, then that's beneficial. Otherwise, if not only 10 but 50 ulama say something and we find out that the Ahlul Bayt have said something else, we'll go against all of them. We say this is what the Ahlul Bayt have said. Everybody agrees with this, from the beginning to the end, as my teacher would say, from Kulaini to Khomeini, everybody, okay, agrees with this. There's no question about it. None of the ulama had a different view. So why do we find this? Why is ijma' considered so important? Well, there's a reason behind it. The reason behind it is, we have hadith, very clear hadith. A number of it, it's not only one to say, okay, you know, how are you accepting that one hadith and explaining this situation here. There's a number of ahadith that very clearly state that the Ahlul Bayt used to give different views to different people. Okay. This reliable companion, he's not lying, he's heard something from the Imam. Okay. One of the companions, this is found in Al-Kafi, okay, in the section, the chapter on Fadlul Ilm, one of the chapters there, if I remember correctly, it's Ikhtilaful Hadith, but possibly maybe in some of the other chapters, but it's definitely in Kitabu Fadlul Ilm. Okay. The companion, the chain of narrators are also reliable. He says, I was in the presence of the Imam. I went to him, I asked him a question. He gave me a response. Okay, it was a practical. I asked him, the Imam said, you do it this way. He doesn't explain what exactly it was. He just wants to tell us and report to us this difference in the answering of the Imam. He says, I asked him a question, the Imam responded a certain way. So I was sitting there, I remained there with the Imam in his presence. Somebody else came from the Shia, he's not a Sunni, it's another of the Shia, one of the other companions. He comes and asks the very same question without any difference. The Imam gives him a completely different response. A third person comes in, asks the same question. The Imam gives him a third response that's completely different from the other two. And he asks the question. The companion asks the question, okay, did I just hear this right? Did I just hear you giving three different views for the very same question, the practical law, there's no difference? Or is there something that I'm not understanding? The Imam says, no, you're right. I did give different responses. But this is to preserve the lives of the Shia. We have two concepts here. One concept is the concept of taqiyya in the sense that the view of Ahlul Sunnah is given to a companion. I think you've all heard the story of Ali ibn Yaqtin. He was told to do the wudu in the way that Ahlul Sunnah do it. Okay. Instead of wiping the head, wash the head. Instead of wiping the feet, wash the feet. Okay. This is the way Ahlul Sunnah do it. Where that started, I don't want to get into that. But anyway, the imams, that's one form of taqiyya. Doing something exactly the same way that Ahlul Sunnah do it. Okay, that's one form of taqiyya. But another thing that happened is this, that the Ahlul Bayt did not want in certain regions for all of the Shia to do the same thing so they could be identified. The Ja'faris act in this way. As soon as you see someone praying in this way, you can know they're a Ja'fari, you can kill them. Okay. If they are given different views, one practices one way, the other one practices a different way, they're not going to know which one is the Ja'fari way. They're not going to figure out who is this person. He's going around as a Shia, okay, practicing, obeying his Imam, but people are not going to be able to recognize because the Shia weren't able to go and say we're Shia, obviously. That was at some points in history that was, you know, they could lose their life. People weren't able to talk about it. Others would be able to tell if they're Shia or not through their practice. One clear example in that example of Ali ibn Yaqtin is that the Imam told him to perform wudu in the Sunni way, so they won't be able to recognize him based on his action. Okay. Now, the Imam tells these different companions to act differently, so they're not identified as Shia. Okay. This is mentioned in too many of our ahadith. Okay. Now, this hadith is reported. This person, as a reliable person, came to the presence of the Imam, asked him a question. Okay. The Imam responded to it. A person narrates it, somebody else narrates it, and we have it today. They're both reliable people. The Imam did say that. But one of them is actually his view. The other one is said just to give another practice for the Shia not to be recognized. How do we figure that out? The Ahlul Bayt have given us an instruction for that. When you have Ikhtilaful Hadith, I'm not giving a general, don't take this like as a class of fiqh and try to apply it yourself. There's a lot of details there. But one of the things there, when you have Ikhtilaful Hadith, differences in Hadith, the Imam says, خُذْ بِمَشْتَهَرَ بَيْنَ أَصْحَابِكَ. See what is known amongst the ulama, amongst the companions. You think the ulama, Shaykh Tusi didn't see this hadith? He's reported it in his book. Kulaini didn't see this hadith? He's reported it in the book. Shaykh As-Saduq didn't see this hadith? He's reported it in his book. Yes, the Imam has said this. However, my view is against this because it is known in the environment of the Shia, it is crystal clear that the view of the Imam, for example, and I'm presenting Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khoi, and the others that believe it to be, believe them to be najis, okay. It is crystal clear amongst the people, the Shia, the ulama of the time, that the view of the Imams is that Ahlul Kitab are najis, okay. And this is a general concept. They say that an ijma' is able to go against a hadith that is considered reliable. For what reason? For the reason, one of the reasons is what I just explained. There's other reasons also, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background regarding that. Okay. The process of ijtihad is not something that one can just wonder about in and explore and try to see, you know, what we can do and put a couple of things together and feel like, you know, I can argue with people like people are doing in forums. Okay. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to increase our understanding and enable us to, inshallah, put those teachings into practice, inshallah.